Welcome to the People's School of Marxist-Leninist Studies. The time is January 16th, 2024. And tonight we'll be doing the right to housing, work, and education in the USSR. This is a three-volume Soviet film that was part of our Soviet Film Archive project. And these films were made in connection with the 1977 Soviet Constitution. So it'll be a little bit more relaxed this evening. We'll be going over each film and then having a discussion period. And so tonight we will be learning first a little background on the Soviet Constitution of 1977 with some background on the 1924 and 1936 constitutions. I spelled that wrong. Whoops. And then we'll be going over each film. We'll be going through the right to work, the right to housing, and the right to education. So first, for a little background on the Soviet Constitution of 1977. So I'm not sure how many know, but throughout the history of the USSR, there were three constitutions that were written. The first one was the 1924 Constitution of the Soviet Union, which was adopted on January 31st, and this was also known as the Lenin Constitution. The second constitution that was adopted on December 5th, 1936, and is also called the Stalin Constitution. And then on October 7th, 1977, the 1977 Constitution of the USSR was adopted, and this was also known as the Brezhnev Constitution. So, just a little background on some of the earlier ones. So, for the Soviet Constitution of 1924, this legitimized the 1922 treaty on the creation of the USSR that was done between the Russian Soviet Federative Socialist Republic, the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic, the Belarusian Soviet Republic, and the Transcaucasian Soviet Federative Socialist Republic. That last one is what is now Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Georgia. This constitution was 72 articles total. This was originally based off of the 1918 constitution of the Russian Soviet Federative Socialist Republic. And this constitution basically set up the USSR and also set as the highest legislative bodies the Federal Soviet and the Soviet of the Nationalities. For the 1936 constitution, this is the one that established now that the USSR was a union of independent nations, including the Armenian, Azerbaijan, Georgian Soviet Socialist Republics from the Transcaucasian Soviet Federative Republic. This also established a Turkmen, Uzbek, Kazakh, Tajik, Kyrgyz, and other Soviet socialist republics as well. The highest decision body was now the Supreme Soviet, and this consisted of the Soviet of the Union, which was basically the proportional representative body, and the Soviet of Nationalities, which was still the legislative body that was made up of every nationality and ethnic group in the Soviet Union. There were now new sections that were defined the right to work, the right to rest and leisure, maintenance in old age and sickness, and education for all. There is also a section just for women in the USSR having equal rights, as well as equal rights for all nationalities within the Soviet Union. So the Soviet Constitution of 1977 set law into law the following. The structure of the new constitution of the USSR differs from that of previous Soviet constitutions. It had a preamble. The section on the individual stands at the head of the text. This was later broken down into a section called the State and the Individual, Section 2. It contained some new chapters, and for convenience, the text was divided into sections. And all in all, there were nine sections with 21 chapters. There were 174 articles total, or about 28 more than the 1936 Constitution. A section titled The State and the Individual gave the right of housing, work, and education, while also stating that citizens had a duty to take care of housing. From Leonid Brezhnev's own words here. As our experience has shown, the gradual development of the state proletarian dictatorship into a state of the whole people is one of the results of the complete triumph of socialist social relations. The Soviet Union today is a natural, inevitable stage in the development of the state born of the October Revolution. a state characteristic of mature socialism. Consequently, the tasks of the state institutions, their structures, functions, and work procedures should conform to the stage attained in the development of society. And I would honestly like to do a class later on the Soviet constitutions, because I think there's some interesting legalese work that goes behind how everything's changed here. And per Boris Toporin on the new constitution of the USSR, published in 1980 by Progress Publishers, substantial changes took place in the political life of Soviet society within the framework of the 1936 constitution. Social relations gained in strength. And although the society continued to be divided into classes and social strata, they drew much closer together. This was facilitated by two main circumstances. First, there were no longer exploitative elements, and the society consisted only of the laboring classes and social strata. Second, their unity was based on the common interests that found reflection in the policy and ideology of the working class. This was the way how a new social and international community, the Soviet people, was formed. The nature of power changed accordingly. The dictatorship of the proletariat had fulfilled its mission. The victory of socialism in the USSR was final and complete. At that stage of history, the need for proletarian dictatorship obviated, for it had grown into the power of the whole people. The state of proletarian dictatorship turned into a socialist state of the whole people. Socialist democracy was further developed and socialist legality strengthened. Thus, the Soviet people brought the country to new historical frontiers that opened the stage of developed socialism. The main task at this stage is the all-round perfection of socialist society, the fuller and more effective use of its potentialities and advantages on the way to further advance to communism. With the advent of Soviet society to the stage of developed socialism, the need arose for carrying out a regular constitutional reform. The potentialities of the 1936 Constitution proved to be exhausted and its framework transcended. For this reason, wide support was given to the proposal to draft and adopt a new constitution. Its draft was prepared by the Constitutional Commission set up by the Supreme Soviet of the USSR. And really quickly, before we get to the films, I did want to stop for a little discussion period there, because in doing research on this constitution itself, I found it very interesting that they kept using the phrase of matured socialism, and they had gone beyond the proletariat of the dictatorship of the proletarian, and that this was now a closer state to communist growth. While I was not able to, there was no actual substantiations of some of the claims that, well, they thought they had reached the perfect society. There was still talk from Brezhnev and other leaders about this is now we work towards full communism. This constitution was actually intended to run up until about the year 2000. So 20 years ago, or the early 20s, 2000s, if the Soviet Union was still around, we would have probably seen perhaps a new constitution or even an amendment process. So,
Yeah, so if I can speak, and perhaps on behalf of Angelo, one thing I know from him is he actually lived and studied in the Soviet Union, and he did trips to different socialist countries. And he went to the Soviet Union, and what he said, the first thing he did, he got off the plane and he kissed the ground. He got off the stairs and he kissed the ground. For us now, as you said, in 2024, especially in our country among the left, it's like an internet discussion group. But at this point in time, the Soviet Constitution, the whole country was a socialist country. And one of the things which we are, not in our party, but many in our country are confused today is that the Soviet Union was communist. It was run by the Communist Party, but it was socialist. So the country was socialist. And Marx and Lenin, everybody writes about this, the stages. So it doesn't go overnight. You know, there's a revolution, and then it's suddenly the whole country and society was communist. It was socialist with things like the quote, to each according to his ability, to each according to his need. So it was not necessarily equal. people with certain specialties, professionals, people with skills and things. They obviously dealt with a lot more than basic laborers, but at the same time, and they have more available to them. At the same time, the needs for everybody were provided. There was no unemployment. There was housing, transportation, as spoken by Comrade Angelo. It was like the equivalent today of like 5 cents, and it never went up. And the Soviet cities are designed in a way that you can get everywhere with public transport. And Angelo would say this if he was here now, but one of the things he saw all over the country, there were these big banners, and it said on the road towards communism. So it was a socialist society, a socialist country, and they said on the road towards communism. If Angelo was here, he would tell you this too. So at the time he was there at the Soviet Union, like things we have now, supermarkets, that was like a new thing over there. Because before that, this is all socialist, of course, but you would go to the bread store for your bread, go to the meat store for your meat. The idea of the supermarket, like American style, where everything was put together like that, was just hitting. And on the issue of like eras in the Soviet Union, one of the things we've seen in the past in our studies here at the school and in other things, so Stalin is associated with heavy industry and like the construction of the country. But had he continued living at the time of Khrushchev, Khrushchev is sort of known for the time of like light industry and kind of like products, almost like a consumerism, if you will. But it's because during Stalin's time, that whole process was being created, like the heavy industry, the industrialization of the country happened in like 10 years, basically in the 30s before World War II. And then during Khrushchev's era, the light industry and kind of consumer products, whatever you would think, like lamps, just like stuff you would use in your house, maybe like makeup stuff, stuff for your face, kitchen utensils, like all the
Right.
small stuff. Yeah, it was being built then. But the Soviet Union did maintain socialism under Khrushchev. What would happen later would be there would be the black market would happen.
My question is whether we're talking about going from the first to the second constitution or the second to the third constitution, what prompted the need to form a new constitution in the first place? Obviously, here in America, we have like the same constitution this whole time, but we have like an amendment process that we do use to try and make it last longer, I guess you could put. But I was just wondering, for whatever reason, why would what would bring about needing to reform the whole Constitution in the first place? Thank you.
Thank you. So there's a lot of mention in a lot of the texts that I looked up for this, both from Brezhnev himself and others who were writing about the Constitution at the time, that the 36th Constitution had it was either outlasted or it's the framework within it working was too bound and there needed to be a new structure. Though there was never mention of who was the originator behind that constitution. Maybe that's a factor I could not tell you.
Yeah, so I've heard from a few other countries that it's not uncommon to have a like a regularly scheduled rewriting of the Constitution, like say they redo it every 25 years or something like that to meet the material conditions of the present day. And it's an interesting concept when you think about it because we know that through the amendment system, it can be stalled, it can be stopped. Right? Like what's happened in America today. There hasn't been an amendment in a very long time. So while there is potential for regression, reactionary backsliding through rewriting of the Constitution, it can also be used as a means of keeping the form of the government current to the needs of the people, provided that the state is in the hands of the working class, of course.
Thank you, Comrade Jesse.
Yeah, Which, between the 1936 Constitution and the 1977 Constitution, which one would we say more resembles the constitutions used by modern socialist republics?
That I could honestly not tell you because I haven't really done a deep dive into the structure of either constitution, but I can probably bet that either both of them have influenced other socialist constitutions.
Yeah, that was a good question. Both of them obviously influence other socialist countries today. Like you have Cuba, definitely the DPRK, and we'll have to study those constitutions in their own classes. But the Soviet countries or the socialist countries themselves, each one was different. You know, in the east of Europe, there were socialist countries, and each one was different. And unfortunately, Angelo's not here, but he also went to Hungary at the time, and their constitution was different, and they had something called goulash communism.
So we will now start the videos. The first one we'll be showing tonight will be the right to work.
To work. Moscow is the capital of the first state of workers and peasants in the world. In a country where the most important human right, the right to work, is secured in the fundamental law, the Constitution of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. This motion picture tells its audiences how the right to work is ensured in reality. The school children of yesterday are choosing their future professions today. True, among those applying for enrollment at higher schools, there are many young people who had already decided on their future while still at school. But it's no easy task, particularly if there are so many higher and specialized secondary schools, vocational schools, and various short-term courses. Professional orientation begins at school in the USSR. On certain days, school children go with their teachers to meet highly skilled specialists and obtain exhaustive information regarding any problem connected with the selection of a job in future. It's of course difficult to say how the destiny of each of these youngsters will shape. Some of them take great pleasure in servicing the children's railway. Others, no doubt, dream of becoming geologists and of discovering new deposits. Still others are fascinated by the rhythmic work of metallurgists. There's no doubting one basic reality. They shall all start out in life with a full right to choose any work that interests them. Soviet power proclaimed the right to work soon after the 1917 Socialist Revolution. The Civil War and the foreign military intervention, however, hindered the implementation of this right. Backward as it had already been, the national economy of the country was practically totally disrupted. The course for industrialization and the collectivization of farming brought unemployment to an end in the USSR. The fundamental law of the country, adopted in 1936, secured equal opportunities and equal rights for all citizens. First Vice Chairman of the USSR State Committee for Labor and Social Problems, Leonid Kostin. The right of Soviet people to work is proclaimed and secured by Article 40 of the Constitution of the USSR. This right is also guaranteed and ensured in the Soviet Union by the planned and uniform development of national economy and by socialist property. With the increase of the working capacity of the population, the plan envisages a corresponding growth in the number of jobs, so as to provide every person with gainful employment. In this country, unemployment was liquidated in 1930, once and for all. The Soviet people, particularly the modern generation, know nothing of and can never recall what unemployment, crises, and labor exchanges actually mean. In the 1977 Constitution of the USSR, the right to work had been added to and extended by the right to the choice of trade or professions, and getting a job in accordance with the profession, training, and education, and the desire of any person with due account for the needs of society. No problems arise in the Soviet Union that are connected with job placement. Engineers, technicians, and specialists of various professions are wanted and invited to work. Such want ads can be seen everywhere. Lvov is the regional center of West Ukraine. Just 40 years ago, it was impossible to find a job here. Now, just as everywhere else in the Soviet Union, one can find a suitable job. Vacancies at various enterprises and establishments flow to job placement offices at the end of every 3 months. Extensive information helps specialists in making a correct choice. Signs a working agreement with the management. There are no limitations of rights and no advantages are given on the basis of sex, race, nationality, or religion in strict accordance with the Constitution of the USSR. The application for the job is voluntary, and the applicant may leave the job whenever he wishes. The worker may be assigned to another job only by his own consent. On his part, every job seeker promises to work conscientiously and to observe labor discipline. The laws and trade unions stand on guard, protecting the interests of office and industrial workers. Chairman of the local trade union committee. Recently, we discussed the reasons given by the management for firing a worker. The trade union committee found that there were insufficient grounds to take such action. The worker remained on his job. Can such a decision be appealed against? The decision of the local union committee cannot be appealed, nor can it be nullified by a higher trade union body. We are present at a discussion of a collective working agreement. The draft agreement has been discussed by workers in every production shop and office of the enterprise. The management of the plant is pledged to fulfill all the provisions of the agreement. Several years ago, the trade union demanded that the management provide all-round assistance in increasing the professional qualifications of workers. Here are the results. There are permanent advanced training courses and a school. Training and education are free of charge, of course. The mastering of new specialties will mean improved professional skills and higher wages, guaranteed in accordance with the country's fundamental law. Scientific progress is bound to keep rendering a powerful influence on the character of labor. Metal cutting lathes and machine tools of the latest designs are being made and tested at the Stanka Konstruktsiya plant in Moscow. The automation and mechanization of labor-consuming processes, production control by means of electronic computers and programming devices, make work much easier. We asked Pyotr Dorodny, chief of this production shop, whether automation and mechanization breeds unemployment. Of course not, he replied. This is our first sector with programming control devices. The operators here currently service 2 to 3 machine tools, and the people released from these jobs have been retrained with no loss in wages. We are short of manpower at times. This is why we're actually interested in releasing people to retrain them. The planned development of the national economy and full employment have excluded the possibility of crisis phenomena and unemployment. The right to work gives assurance in the morrow and in the future of our children. The Alima family from Chirchik, a town in the Uzbek Soviet Socialist Republic. They furnish a vivid example of the dynamic growth in the prosperity of Soviet people. 40 years ago, Kenja Alimov, the head of this dynasty, arrived to work among the builders of the Chirchiq electrochemical plant. That's him on the photo. Nowadays, Kenja Alimov will be quite content. His elder daughter, Hamiya, worked as a machine operator at the plant. She did not break off ties with the plant after retirement, however, and in her talks with schoolchildren, she strives to arouse their interest in workers' professions. Shirali Alimov became a high-skilled specialist. He graduated from the Industrial Technical School with honors and now works as assistant to shift foreman. The youngest daughter, Mayram, works as a lab assistant. The super quality of her analyses has won her great prestige. Granddaughter Clara has disclaimed family tradition and decided to become a lawyer. She's a university student and works at the personnel department of the plant. She has just appointed this boy, who served a stint of the army, to the job he had before being drafted. This is a requirement of labor legislation. Actually, that's the way it was with Uchkun, another grandson of Kenja Alimov. On returning home and to the plant after military service, he was given his old and favorite job. The children and grandchildren of former Dehan peasant Kenja Alimov work in different production shops. Just as any Soviet citizen, each one of them is confident that the principal human right, which is the right to work, is guaranteed to them. Labor in the USSR is voluntary and free. No matter where a person might be employed, his work contributes to the communal wealth, to the welfare of the people. Soviet Union, the socially useful work performed by man and the results of this work determine his place and position in society. Anatoly Bristorobits, direction and photography, Nariman Azimov.
All right, and with that, we will break for our next round of discussion.
I love that they deliver flowers to the workers. I can tell that that would brighten up anyone's day. It really would. I wish people would give me flowers for the work I do. Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to say, we have so-called right to work here in the US, and you can't help but notice the difference between what they call right to work and what we do. There, they had full rights and trade unions rights, and basically there was no counteracting when the trade union fought back for the workers. Here, so-called right to work is just a means for the bosses to exploit the workers more. Thank you.
I have a question about Soviet industry. There was a section where they were talking about PLCs and automation. I personally don't like this term, but this is the term we use in Internet of Things class. Some people claim that the Soviets were the first ones to work on a internet project, but I don't know how true that is. I mean, I know who obviously got to create the DARPA network and so on.
Yeah, I couldn't answer that question for you, to be honest. I know they were working on some, there were some people, I believe, with models that were looking to automate everything. Nothing quite like what they did in Chile, but I think they were starting to integrate some computations and automation into productions. But the extent of that, I couldn't really tell you. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so I noticed in there they said that the trade union bodies it talked about, they decisions made by a trade union body couldn't be overruled by a higher trade union body. And then they also said that management is pledged to fulfill the agreement that the trade union comes across. So did management have any type of bargaining role with the trade union, or were they just supposed to carry out what it was that the trade union planned?
I'm not 100% on what it is, but in the Soviet Union, there were some people that were skilled at managing other people and managing work. But for the most part, there was the planned economy, and then there was what was the local union's bargaining agreement, and management basically pledged to carry out that agreement the best they could. But if someone's got a better answer, I would love to hear it as well. But to answer your question, I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, I remember reading that, like, if a company, if these managers or whatever wanted to fire a worker, like, it had to go through like a real process by the trade unions, and they had to like prove that like the firing was warranted. So like the unions could revoke the firing of a worker. And I don't remember where I read this, but I think it was saying that like the rate of people who got their jobs reinstated by the trade unions was about 50%. So it wasn't infrequent. And I know that trade unions had some pretty wide powers. Like they could even recall like managers, if the manager was like messing up and the workers wanted it. So pretty big contrast to like the powers they had there compared to what they have in the West.
So I donated $100 to the committee to redigitize these films and save them, and I'm very grateful that I did that now, considering this is something you really want to show younger generations, younger than us, really, to show them that it was actually possible to build a world that's just like this, where there is no joblessness or poverty or homelessness of any kind. I remember I was watching a testimony of someone who lived in the Soviet Union. It was a woman, and she moved to the US, and she made the comment that the first time she's ever seen a homeless person was when she moved to the US, which is extremely telling. It also comes down to like those soldiers they were describing coming back after the war, getting their jobs reinstated. That's basically never happened in the US without a fight from the workers. That's just never happened. Historical figures like Douglas MacArthur, who's touted as a great general here in the US, who's in reality fought against World War I veterans to prevent them from getting basic access to money and disability and insurance to help them. It just will not happen here in the US. So This is something you really want to just keep and show as a record for future generations. Thank you.
There was a little bit of confusion when we're comparing labor unions in the US versus a socialist country. They serve completely different roles. You have to understand it from the point of view that in the Soviet Union, there isn't a capitalist class that is antagonistic towards the workers. They are all working for the betterment of society as a whole. Now, there is the issue where there could be bureaucratism in the workplace. And so what they would have is, I think they called it a labor triangle, where they had a representative from the local Soviet, the trade union, and the management, where they would work together to make an agreement on how to better improve labor and working conditions for the people. It has to be understood that one of the jobs of the management was to also make sure that housing conditions and food conditions were ample for the workers. So they weren't antagonistic like they are here in the United States or in any capitalist country.
So I don't know if this is already answered, but like what kind of work opportunities did they have for people who were disabled, or is that outside the scope of this class?
Yeah, my understanding is, they had the ethos of everybody should work. They wanted zero unemployment. So, they worked to sort of accommodate the disability, whatever it was. If there's any sort of job you could work under the conditions of what you're working with, I think they'd try to work with you on that. I think if having you not work at all would probably be a last resort. But that's what how I'd respond to that.
Yeah, while it doesn't necessarily go to disabilities, we can assume that they would fix that. So Angela lived in the Soviet Union. I've been to Russia, and I was there, and we had tables. We were at the last World Festival of Youth and Students in 2017 in Sochi. We had three comrades go, one of which was me, and we had a table, comrades. We had a table at this big event. There were like 20,000 people there, youth people. This is the Olympic Park in Sochi. And this person, this is in Russia, came up to me. And obviously, this is a Russian, and she was talking about her mom and how her mom hated the Soviet Union. This is a young person speaking, so speaking with the tint of a young person, who hates socialism. A lot of that, as you know, is being raised in that area of the world today by social media. And she said this. She said her mom cut grass, but she had a house and she went to school. Moved on, but she, that was her profession. She was like a yard worker and she had housing. So that's my answer to that. A disabled person. Here's a person who has a very remedial job and they still had housing and they were able to go to school. And their children were complaining about that. It was weird. And anyways, all the people that were at us at the table were actually defending the Soviet Union. It was very interesting. So everybody ended up defending the Soviet Union, but that's a real story. Somebody came up to me and talked about their mom.
Yeah, I'm just wondering in sort of like a hypothetical, let's say somebody like did get fired or somebody there was just reason to make it so that they lose their job, just on a purely hypothetical. Obviously getting another job was a lot easier in the Soviet Union than it would be here. But besides that, I'm just wondering, does anybody know like what other ways you like what other sort of accommodations there would be? Like, what would it be like actually going through the process of losing a job and having to make do? I know like housing and being able to feed yourself would be fine in order before you get that next job. But does anybody know anything as far as like whether you'd get like an unemployment check or something like that? That's where my mind's going, and I'm just wondering what we might know.
Well, I couldn't give you a definite answer on that, but one thing is that education was also free. So if you wanted to go perhaps train for another job, there would be that option. Or if there was another something with similar qualifications that you need something for, you could probably train for that. And also, students had a bit of a stipend as well when they were studying.
Yeah, it will be quick. I really recommend the book Cities Without Crisis by, I forget his name, but I'll try to share it in, I think, William Dunn. I just really think a lot of the questions asked, a lot of answers are given in that book. I'll share the link to someone and they can maybe share it to everyone. That's all.
We'll now go on to the second video, which will be the right to housing.
Commissioned by the Union of Soviet Societies of Friendship and Cultural Ties with Foreign Countries. On October the 7th, 1977, the Supreme Soviet of the USSR adopted the nation's new constitution, the Fundamental Law of Developed Socialism. The new Soviet constitution, for the first time in history, proclaims, among other human rights and freedoms, the right to housing. The right to housing. Any right is real only when a person can use it, when it's guaranteed by the society. Today, the Soviet Union is a huge construction site. Nowhere in the world is housing construction proceeding on such a scale as in the USSR. Neighborhoods are rising, traditional centers change. A powerful building industry has been created. Architects are working on new designs. These are cities of tomorrow. In the 10th five-year plan, the state allocated 100 billion rubles for new housing. This is northern Chertanovo, a new neighborhood in Moscow where 20,000 people will live and spacious, comfortable apartments with plenty of greenery and bodies of water. There are already 42,000 people in this new neighborhood of Rusanovka in Kiev, and there are many like it in the Ukrainian capital. In the last 20 years, 232 million Soviet people have moved into new homes and improved their housing conditions. The right to housing was proclaimed in one of the most populated countries of the world, in a country which survived the most devastating war in history. ,000 villages were destroyed in our country during the Second World War. 1,700 cities lay in ruins, like Kreshchatyk, Kiev's main street. great effort and huge funds had to be invested in rehabilitation and new construction, which was pursued at an unprecedented rate. How is the right of our country's citizens to housing implemented in practice? Let's take as an example the automatic machine tool plant in Kyiv, one out of many factories in that city. The factory trade union committee is distributing apartments in a new house built by the factory. The chairman of the housing committee announces the results of a thorough checking and selection of candidates. Not all applicants can receive apartments in the new house. A queue is set up. Preference is given to war invalids, veterans of the factory, and large families. Strict order is maintained. One of those receiving a new apartment is a milling machine operator, Georgi Sishek. Whoever finances housing construction, the city or factory, there's only one owner, the local Soviet of People's Deputies. It checks the correctness of the decision and issues a document confirming the right to occupy the new apartment. This uniform government system assures fair distribution of housing, as specifically stipulated in the new constitution. A new home is always a great joy, especially when the apartment is granted free and for occupation in perpetuity. One of the state's requirements towards the new owners is that they take good care of their housing. We're having a housewarming party, expecting guests. How nice. Congratulations. How do you like your new apartment? It's a good apartment. Three rooms, all of them isolated. The house is in a good neighborhood, not far from work. There are all kinds of municipal transport, and shops are nearby. How much rent do you pay? 21 rubles. What proportion is that of your family budget? About 5%. A good apartment means more than the roof over one's head. It's also the quality of the neighborhood, the fresh air, the greenery. Together with a home, one also needs all that makes an enjoyable life. In response to this requirement, a whole complex goes up in each neighborhood, not only shops, but public utilities, hospitals and polyclinics, movie houses and clubs, sports facilities, schools, and other children's establishments. In all of this, one sees the effort to have residential neighborhoods meet all basic requirements. as in many other cities, the historical center of Tallinn, capital of Estonia, comprises buildings of great architectural value, which create the city's inimitable image, just as Tallinn chimney sweeps give it its special atmosphere. To tell the truth, living in old buildings is not always comfortable. So the builders, while carefully retaining the outward appearance of streets, reconstruct houses from the inside to build comfortable apartments. And the chimney sweeps remain more for local color. Housing maintenance in a big city costs a lot. Nevertheless, the state foots two-thirds of the bill. This is to keep rent down. This is one more guarantee of the right to housing. If, for one reason or another, a family doesn't care to wait for its turn to get a state-owned flat, it can invest in a cooperative. The state helps cooperative building, providing 15-year loans of 60% of the cost of the house. Interest is 0.5% a year. No payment is required for the land. Needn't necessarily be either state or cooperative. It can also be the private property of its owner, like this one, occupied by the Hansen family. Hansen is a cooperative farm architect. All the houses here are built according to his designs. The Edward Vilde Collective Farm lies in the center of Estonia. It's one of many farms in our country. Its main distinction is probably its lakes with trout. The fish provides for a considerable income. Not long ago, the farm began to breed blue foxes. It takes one person to look after them. High labor productivity means high incomes, and of course, new houses. Eric Erelt, the cooperative farm chairman, discusses building plans for a new street in Pajusti village. Even though all the houses are privately owned, the state helps the owners exercise their right to housing by providing loans, building materials, and transport. If you want to live in your own house, you can build it. There's a building committee at the farm. In addition to the chairman and architect, it includes the cooperative farm joiner, Evald Rennell. He built this house with his own hands. conversation drifts to village news. How is the brass band in which Hevold's son is playing? What are their daughter's achievements in the equestrian school? Looking at the life of the Estonian village, one can't help thinking how much a person needs. But the main thing, on which everything else hinges, is confidence in the future. In our country, this confidence is bred by the right to education and the right to work, and many other real rights and freedoms. One of the most vital and important among them is the right to housing. Kim Bakshi.
All right. And we will break there for another round of discussion.
Yeah, very interesting. I have never seen this. I gave you this film. Never had a chance to look at it. Very interesting. Notice the buildings in Kiev, in Ukraine. That was a part of the building. A story, am I right? When he talked about Kiev, the city of Kiev, is that correct? They were destroyed in World War II. It was built by the communists, not by the fascists. I want to point that out to everybody. The Soviet Union rebuilt everything. So in a way, when I see buildings being destroyed in the Ukraine now, they were all built by the Soviet Union. None of them have been built by the capitalists. Remember that. So the destruction of the Ukraine was the Ukraine that was we built, that the communists built in the Ukraine. I find that very interesting. And when I lived there, that's exactly how it was. It was great. I'm telling you, it was. I have seen the future, and the future works. That quote from an American is. Writer. And that's what I saw when I was there. Thank you.
Thank you, Comrade Angelo. I also found it interesting they showed the city of Lvov during the Right to Work film, even though that's now kind of where all the Ukrainian nationalists and fascists are coming out of.
Yeah, one thing this just reminded me of was Angelo told us that one time he went to the Soviet Union, it was like the 70s, and he told people, like people asked him, like, well, what do you do for work? What's your job? And he told people, like, oh, I'm actually unemployed right now. And he's like, they looked at him like he was crazy. Like, they didn't know what unemployment was.
Correct. That is so correct. They look at me like I had two heads on my shoulder. Say, what do you mean? Everybody has to have a job. Can you believe that? When there was so much unemployment under capitalism. But you're correct.
Another thing that was discussed in Cities Without Crisis by Mike Davidow that wasn't mentioned in these videos was so Mike Davidow, I mean, he was an American, so he saw both sides of it. He went to the Soviet Union, and one of the things that stuck out the most to him was that when he went through the cities, there weren't blocks of the city devoted to a certain national group or racial group like we do in the U.S., meaning there weren't slums, there wasn't the economic segregation among races. And he also talks about how You know, there were obviously people that had better paying jobs than others, but they all lived in the same communities as each right. other.
I want to add to that. The manager of the factory lived in the same building as the workers in the factory. Isn't that amazing? The manager of the factory lived in the same building, neighbors, with the people that were workers at that factory. That is correct.
Thank you, comrade. I just wanted to say that it's really incredible to see how the workers, the average citizen, was treated with dignity. That is the key word that stands out to me here. You are not just having the basic necessities for life parceled out to you one by one and causing the constant stress that causes strain. And when the worker is stressed like that because of the constant need and barrage of costs as they extract profits from us in every facet of our lives, leads to stress. It leads us to not be able to raise our children appropriately, which leads to generational issues. And it's all stemming from this. But you can imagine a world where we work on a cooperative farm together. Comrades, what I would give to work on a cooperative farm with you and live that simple life. But I'll take working for it for our children instead.
Honestly,
a very good point. This is Angela. It's amazing the lack of stress that exists in the socialism when I lived there. Every 3 minutes, a bus came to the bus stop. Every 3 minutes, all during the day, not just during rush hour. All right? So imagine, you don't need a car. Why would you need a car if you can get on the bus? Just walk out of your door, get on the bus, and go wherever you want. And it was 5 kopecks. And it stayed 5 kopecks forever. It was like a nickel. And the other thing is Riga. I went to visit Riga many times in Estonia. Do you realize that that city was preserved by the Soviet communist? They preserved it, not the fascists that are ruling in that area now. Thank you.
Okay, yeah. So that the allied organization to the school, the Party of Communist USA, has an office in Seattle, and now another office is in Vermont. And in the past, Angelo, you can attest to this, but there was the International Working Man's Order or Workers' Order, which was like this extra layer just between working people of all sorts of things, like insurance, you know, dental, helping with rent or with things like that. So maybe we'll bring that back, and maybe we should have people, if they're able to with their jobs, get together and work together. This is a long time commitment. We're talking about all of our lives until we're Angelo's age, and the respect that we'll have between our comrades, you know, respect and integrity. I could see us starting to form actual communities, and I think that's what it's going to take for us to make a presence in our country.
Yeah, it just seems like such an alien society, the former Soviet Union. And I was reading, and this blew my mind because it goes against every Western propaganda piece that, you know, the communists were out to take your toothbrush and they were going to tax you and everything, but they didn't really have taxes. There weren't taxes. So I think it was something like 80% of the Soviet income was something for them. Like they had it for spending purposes or whatever. It's just bizarre because we have taxes here and you get screwed over by them. You don't even know what it is. It's confusing sometimes, but they didn't even have to bother with that. That's all.
I want to add to that. Savings account in the banks were the biggest during the Soviet times. So why did they invest their money in a savings account? Because they didn't have to pay for transportation. They didn't have to pay for private schools. They didn't have to pay for housing. They didn't have to pay. You know, did you know that every worker had a 1 month free paid vacation, paid every worker by the state. Okay? And they worked in conjunction with the union. When I was there, every trade union had two or three hotels in every city. So the workers got, so they went to places like Crimea, all right, where there was sun, beaches, and palm trees. You would never think that. They tell you that Russia is all snow and Siberia, right? That's the way the West pictures it. But that's not the way it was. And don't forget Cuba. They went to Cuba and their vacation was paid. Thank you.
Yeah, so another thing not mentioned in the video for, I guess more for any women viewers, you know, the beauty of the right to housing and right to jobs was part of the right to work in the Soviet Union included child care for women. So they had free child care, they had cheap housing, they had a guaranteed job. So they did not have to be dependent financially on a spouse that, you know, so you could imagine the amount of spousal abuse or spousal mortality in the Soviet Union was not even comparable to what it is here.
Did you want to? Yeah, respond? Real quick, kind of very trivial question, but the part where they were raising blue foxes, any reason? Is there like, is that like a national symbol? Why blue foxes?
I'm not 100% sure, but I think there was something with their pelts, and I'm seeing some hands shoot up.
Okay, they were, that makes sense. Answer.
But so for now, unless there's any other hands, we will go to our wrap up. Okay. All right. And before we close out, Comrade Angelo, did you have any closing remarks for us?
Yeah, I want to thank everybody for showing up. Most of the country right now is under some kind of a chill. You should all know that. I came on late because the wires, the electrical wires, ice froze and broke the wires, so there was no electricity in New York. So a country that needs an infrastructure renewal, remember, we have 200 or 300. Some of the things in this country are 100, 150, 180, 200 years old. Needs to be replaced. And where does the government send the money? Do they help us? Think about it. Or are they sending it around the world to their agenda, like building fascism and NATO in the Ukraine? Like taking people out of Gaza so that they can use the land for a Zionist colonization. Think about it, where the money is going. That's why we need to get involved electorally in politics. We should not shun that. Remember what Lenin did. He organized politically in the Russian Duma. Don't forget that. Thank you.
Thank you, Comrade Angelo. And we'll close with the Internationale.
Arise, you prisoners of salvation. Arise, you wretched of the earth. For justice thunders condemnation. Forbear our world's infirm.
Thank you for watching this full-length class from the People's School for Marxist-Leninist Studies. For more information, or to join our free classes, visit our website, check out our YouTube, listen to our streams on Spotify, and chat with us on Reddit.